Well, we're considering then this well-known New Testament character, Peter. And we said in our first study last week that it's always tempting when considering any biblical character to dive straight into the more shameful episodes in that character's life. But as we said, that temptation, I think, ought to be resisted. In Psalm 103, verse 9, we are told that God does not always accuse. That, if you like, is an attribute of God, that he does not always accuse. And it seems to me that you couldn't get much greater testimony to that fact than when you consider the lives of the leading characters in the Bible, and the way in which God, by his Spirit, has chosen to present those lives to us. Because you see there very clearly, don't you, in the Bible and in these biographical sketches of these men and women, that God is a God who does not always accuse. When you read the tabloid newspapers, they are always accusing, aren't they? Always exposing, always condemning, always unearthing skeletons in the cupboard. This famous person, look at what he's done. This famous person, look at what she's been up to. But when you come to the Bible, it's so different. When you come to the Bible, it's not relentlessly accusing. But there's a discreet manner, there's a sensitive manner, there's a generous manner in the way in which its leading characters are described. And that's nowhere more evident than in the life of this man, Peter. And so that's why then I was so concerned last week to begin this series, not on the note of Peter's failings and Peter's more shameful episodes, but to begin this series on the note of Peter, an outstanding believer. And that then is what we looked at last week. But having begun on that note, it must be conceded, of course, that Peter did fail. Peter did have shameful episodes, and those shameful episodes are part of the New Testament record. Indeed, as I think I perhaps said in a different connection a few weeks ago, this is one of those many little touches which points, I think, so strongly to the authenticity of the New Testament record. You see, people will say to us things like this. They will say that what you have in the Gospels is some reports of Jesus' speech and some reports of Jesus' actions that are pretty true, that correspond to the truth pretty closely. But then alongside that, you have a whole load of other material in the Gospels which doesn't correspond to the truth at all. The material that contains supernatural phenomena, miracles and exorcisms and voices from heaven and that kind of thing. And this material then, that is simply the additions, the embellishments of the early church, because they wanted to portray Christ as this great supernatural figure, and so they added this stuff, they embellished the true accounts and the real accounts of what Jesus said and did. Now you just imagine that for a minute. You imagine that's true. And you imagine then Peter and James and John and others sitting there around a table trying to decide exactly what the story of Jesus should look like, what they want it to look like. This story of Jesus that they're going to unleash to the world, they're sitting there deciding what they want to go in. And these men, they don't have any integrity whatsoever, they don't have any interest in the truth. Everything's up for grabs, and they're busy inserting all these things that didn't really happen, all these miracles, all these exorcisms, all these voices from heaven. And they're busy removing all these things that did happen, but they don't want the world to know about. The times when Jesus lost his temper, the times when Jesus got drunk, and all the rest of it. Imagine that's what's going on. Well, you'd have thought, wouldn't you, that if that were the case, at some point Peter might have coughed sheepishly and said, hang on a minute, boys. While we're doing all this, while we're inserting all this stuff that didn't really happen, while we're removing all this other stuff that did happen, would you mind awfully if we removed something else? If we remove that bit where I deny Jesus three times, would you mind if we just erase that? Because it's a bit embarrassing for me, and it doesn't really help my credibility as a leader within the Christian community. Would you mind if we just quietly got rid of that? You'd have thought, wouldn't you, that it would be almost inevitable. If that's what they were doing, sitting around that table, everything up for grabs, inevitably they'd have got rid of that. And yet you read Matthew's gospel, Peter's denial is there. You read Mark's gospel, Peter's denial is there. You read Luke's gospel, Peter's denial is there. You read John's gospel, Peter's denial is there. And I'm saying then that this New Testament emphasis on Peter's failing, like so many other details that we could mention, surely exposes this whole idea of early church embellishment as a completely ridiculous one. But anyway, I digress somewhat. The important point is that Peter's failings, as I say, are there. They're part of the New Testament record, and that means that we cannot neglect them. And therefore, our second title tonight is Peter, a Flawed Disciple. Now, the point in Peter's life then, as we've already intimated, where his discipleship is most obviously flawed, is when he denies Jesus those three times on the night that Jesus was arrested. But that is not the only point in Peter's life where his discipleship is quite obviously flawed. And while we're going to come to the denial in a few moments, I just want to begin by drawing two lessons which I think emerge from Peter's failings as a whole within the Gospels. Two lessons. Lesson number one then. We must beware aspects of our characters which aren't necessarily wrong in themselves. I'll say that again. We must beware aspects of our characters which aren't necessarily wrong in themselves. How would you describe Peter? What words would you use? Well, I think one word that I would use to describe Peter is the word forward. Peter was a highly forward individual, wasn't he? No matter what has just been said, no matter what has just been done, you can always count on Peter to speak out. Of all the disciples, you can always count on him, can't you, to speak out. He was a very forward individual. And this particular characteristic of Peter's gave rise to some quite magnificent utterances. You think of Matthew 16:16, we considered it last week. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. You think of John 6:68, which again we considered last week. Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. Or you think of Acts 2 and that wonderful spontaneous sermon which Peter preached on the day of Pentecost. Now, if Peter weren't then a forward individual, if he was a reserved and retiring type, then we wouldn't have those magnificent utterances, would we? So this particular characteristic of Peter, it gave rise to some quite magnificent utterances. But it also gave rise to some pretty foolish utterances. You think of the Mount of Transfiguration and Peter blurting out there, Lord, let's make three shelters. As if they could just stay permanently there amidst the glory of the mountaintop, as if they could just kind of freeze history at that point and forget everything else and forget the mission which Jesus had to complete, not on the mountaintop, but in the valley bottom, indeed, in the darkness of Golgotha, as if they could do that, which of course was preposterous. Or you think of John 13, earlier on in the chapter from where we read earlier, when Jesus is going to wash their feet. And remember how Peter will have none of this. And he blurts out, Lord, are you going to wash my feet? To which Jesus has to reply, you do not realize, Peter, what I am doing. And you see then how we have here an aspect of Peter's character then, which isn't wrong in itself and which indeed has much potential for good. And yet which also has dangerous potential and must therefore be carefully managed. And I think there's a lesson in that for all of us today. You see, if it's your character to be short-tempered and fly off the handle with everyone, then it's pretty obvious, isn't it, that that needs to be carefully managed. Or if it's your character to give up on things and to throw in the towel, then again, it's pretty obvious that that has to be carefully managed. Or if it's your character to enjoy the sound of your own voice and switch off whenever anyone else talks, then again, it's pretty obvious that that has to be carefully managed. But what if it's your character to be laid back? Well, there's much potential for good in that, isn't there? It probably means you're not likely to be going around looking for fights and looking for confrontations all the time. But there's also dangerous potential there, isn't there? Because it might mean that you're not as troubled as you ought to be by personal sin and by the plight of unbelievers around you and by national moral scandals like abortion and things like that. Or what about if it's your character to be analytical? Again, there's much potential for good there, isn't there? It means that you're not likely to be duped by anybody. You're not likely to be deceived. You're not likely to have the wool pulled over your eyes. But again, there's dangerous potential too. It might mean that you become unduly critical and disapproving of almost everybody you ever meet. Or what about if it's your character to be highly adaptable? Again, much potential for good. You're not likely to become bound mindlessly to traditions, groundless traditions. But again, there's dangerous potential that you might easily become swept along simply by every passing trend and every passing fad. And you see what I'm saying then, that Peter is reminding us that we must be very vigilant, that there's a fine line, isn't there, between our strengths and our weaknesses. The same characteristic can tend in both directions. And we might have characteristics in us that are a blessing. They're a blessing from God. We might have characteristics in us that are the envy of other Christians around us. And yet we mustn't be complacent about that. And we must recognize that all our characteristics need to be carefully managed. So that's lesson number one. Lesson number two, we must beware the devil. We must beware the devil. Now, it may not be a very jolly subject, but I think there's much to be gained from studying the different ways in which the devil operates within the Bible. Now, often in the Bible, he operates by quite simply and straightforwardly prompting people to sin, prompting people to disobey God. So in 1 Chronicles 21, he prompts David to take a national census, which may to you and me, without looking into it, seem fairly harmless, but presumably it was a census that was driven by altogether wrong motives. On Acts chapter 5, he prompts a man called Ananias to lie against God concerning his financial affairs. Or in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, the reason it's so important that the Corinthian believers don't neglect sexual intimacy within their marriages is because if they don't, then they'll be susceptible, they'll be liable to Satan's adulterous promptings. And we see this form of the devil's operation in Peter's experience, I think. In Peter's experience, we see the devil just simply and straightforwardly prompting him to sin. You might want to look at Luke chapter 22. In Luke 22 and verse 31. Jesus says these words to Peter, "Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift you as wheat, but I have prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail, and when you have turned back, strengthen your brothers." Now it's quite clear from the context, from the ensuing verses, that Jesus is referring here to Peter's denial. It's not entirely clear what exactly this image means of sifting you as wheat. There's different views on that. It's unparalleled in the rest of the Bible. But clearly, in some way or other, Satan's prompting was going to be behind Peter's denial. Satan was going to have a hand in this. Behind what Peter was going to do that night, Satan was going to be involved. And so I'm saying then that in the experiences of these different men in Scripture, including Peter, we see the devil operating in this very simple and straightforward way, just prompting somebody to sin. And we must beware that, mustn't we? We must be aware of this possibility and this danger and of the devil's operating in this manner. You may have heard that rather silly little phrase that I can resist anything except temptation. And it is a silly little phrase, but it's a phrase to which we can relate, can't we? It's a phrase that, it's a sentiment that resonates with us. Sometimes, perhaps in church on a Sunday, we use this word temptation as though it were just a piece of theological jargon almost. Just a component from within our theological system almost. And yet out there in the world, it's not just a piece of jargon, is it? Out there in the workplace, it's not just a piece of jargon. Out there in front of the television screen, it's not just a piece of jargon. Out there when you're on the internet, it's not just a piece of jargon. It's real, and it's powerful, and it's devastating, and it's compelling. Why is that? Why is temptation so problematical? Why does it cause us so many difficulties? Well, one answer to that, you see, is that behind the temptation, behind the thing itself that's attracting us, is Satan. This same Satan who was lurking in the shadows there on that cold, dark night in the high priest's courtyard. That same Satan who there in that courtyard was prompting Peter to respond to those servant girls, "No, I don't know Jesus Christ. I'm nothing to do with him." That same Satan is active behind our temptations and behind the promptings that we experience to sin. He operates still in this very simple and straightforward manner. But in Peter's experience, we see the devil operating in another manner as well. In a more subtle manner, I think. We see him operating in this way. In using one person as an instrument and as a vehicle to get at another person. The passage I'm thinking of, as some of you may already have appreciated, is Mark's Gospel chapter 8. Well-known words. Mark chapter 8, verse 31. We read this: "He," that is Jesus, "then began to teach them," that is the disciples, "that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. 'Get behind me, Satan,' he said. 'You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men.'" And this is very interesting, isn't it? Because what we see here then is not Satan prompting Peter to take a national census, like in David's case. And it's not Satan prompting Peter to lie against God about his financial dealings, as in the case of Ananias. And it's not Satan prompting Peter to go and sleep with a prostitute, as in the case of the believers in Corinth. And it's not Satan in this instance prompting Peter to go and deny Jesus three times. Indeed, Peter here doesn't seem to do much that's remarkable at all. He doesn't seem to do anything that's particularly outrageous, does he? All he does is rebuke Jesus when Jesus has spoken about his forthcoming sufferings. And that rebuke is a very understandable rebuke, isn't it? It's a very well-meaning rebuke. It's a very natural rebuke. Peter loves Jesus. He doesn't want this talk of suffering. And so he says, no, Jesus, don't talk about that kind of thing. But you see, Peter's understandable and natural and well-meaning words had the potential to be an enormous stumbling block to Jesus. Because they risked, you see, diverting Jesus from that mission which he had had on his heart from all eternity, that mission given to him by his Father, that mission to go to Golgotha and lay down his life. And that's why then Jesus sees behind these apparently harmless words the hand of Satan. And again, I think we need to be aware of this particular tactic of the devil. He doesn't always operate simply and straightforwardly, prompting somebody to sin. Sometimes he operates in this more subtle manner, getting at one person via another person. You know how Paul in 1 Corinthians 12 describes the church, doesn't he, as a body, as an organism, if you like, in which all the different parts, all the different members are so intimately connected, just as in a physical body, all the different parts are so intimately connected. And that, of course, is a wonderful reality, isn't it? And it's a reality with many, many happy implications. But it's a reality, too, which the devil will try and exploit. And the devil, you see, will seek to use this interconnectedness of believers within the Church of Christ. He will seek to use these close bonds that there are, and he will seek to get at one person via another. To use the body imagery, he'll seek to get at a hand via an elbow, to get at an ankle via a knee. And again, then, we must be very vigilant about this. We must be on the lookout for this. And particularly, perhaps, it should affect the way in which we talk. Because so often I think he probably does this through careless speech. That's what we see with Peter here. It's just careless speech. Again, it's just Peter blurting something out on the spur of the moment that came to his head. And particularly we need to watch out for that within the church, where we are so intimately connected. Careless words is the stuff which the devil thrives upon, I think, in his anti-Christian and anti-church activity. So those are two lessons then which emerge from Peter's failings as a whole. But just as we close this evening, let's just think briefly about the denial specifically. And I just want to ask one question really. How did this come about? How did things reach a point where Peter denied Jesus three times? If you've read the Gospels, if you've reflected upon this man Peter, you can't deny, can you, that Peter loved Jesus. Peter was a keen, earnest disciple. As we saw last week, he was an outstanding believer, a man of outstanding, remarkable faith. He wasn't this kind of cold, peripheral figure. He was Peter the Rock. That's what his name meant. Well, how did this come about? How did the Rock come on this occasion to be so fickle? How did the Rock on this occasion come to be so swayed? How did this come about? Well, I just want to quickly identify three deficiencies in Peter's approach to that night. Three deficiencies in Peter's approach to that night. First of all, there was a deficiency in his self-awareness. There's a deficiency in his self-awareness. We read earlier on John chapter 13, the last part of that chapter. And there in those verses, you remember, Jesus announces to his disciples that he's about to go. Soon he's going to leave them. He's referring then to his return to heaven via, of course, the cross and the resurrection and the ascension. And you remember how Peter is very taken up by this. He won't let it go. It's interesting, isn't it, how Jesus in verse 33 announces this, that he's going soon. And then in verses 34 and 35, he goes on to something else. He begins to talk about this new command I'm giving you, to love one another. He almost changes the subject, and yet Peter won't change the subject. And in verse 36, he comes back to this other business. Lord, where are you going? Peter is very intrigued by this announcement that Jesus is going to go. And Jesus says, look, where I'm going, you can't follow now, but you will follow later. And Peter is indignant about this. Lord, why can't I follow you now? And then this claim, I will lay down my life for you. And it was in that kind of spirit then that Peter approached this night, the night of Jesus' arrest. In this spirit of absolute self-confidence. It was with this attitude that I can cope. Whatever pressures, whatever temptations, whatever intimidations come my way, I can cope. I can lay down my life for Jesus. He was in no doubt about that. Any other scenario was unthinkable to Peter. It was inconceivable. He was full of absolute self-confidence. And really, it was an utterly inexcusable self-confidence. When you think of Peter's own relatively recent experience, you know that incident in Matthew 14, where the disciples are on a boat, and Sea of Galilee gets rough, there's a squall, and Jesus, remember, comes out to them astonishingly walking on the water. And remember how Peter says, Lord, let me walk on the water, let me come to you. And so Peter steps out of the boat, and astonishingly, he too, by the Lord's enabling, walks on the water for a few minutes at least. But then you remember he begins to sink. Why? Because he takes his eyes away from Jesus and suddenly becomes very aware of the storm and the elements and the dangers and the risks. And he begins to go under and he needs Jesus to stretch out a hand and pull him back. And Peter should have known, shouldn't he, from that he was a fallible man. He should have known that he was weak. He should have known that he couldn't cope, that his faith wasn't really all that strong. And you see, if Peter had known that, if he had learnt the lessons from Matthew 14, if he had learnt the lessons from that night on the Sea of Galilee, then as he approached that courtyard, as he saw there in front of him that scene, the fire there in the middle of the courtyard, and all these people milling about, all these soldiers, rough soldiers with intimidating faces, and all these other people, none of whom had any time for Jesus, many of whom perhaps were actively opposed to him. As he saw that scene, if he had been sufficiently aware of his own weakness, the red lights would have begun to flash then, wouldn't they? The alarm bells would have begun to ring at that point. And I'm not saying that he would then or should then have turned round and decided not to go into that courtyard at all, but at least he would have been prepared. The lights would have been flashing, the alarm bells ringing, but because, you see, he hadn't learnt the lesson, because he was so confident, I will lay down my life for you. No red lights flashed, no alarm bells sounded. And that made him so susceptible, so unprepared, when the servant girl came up to him, when another man came up to him and started to interrogate him. And it's a lesson for us all, isn't it? That we need to have that self-awareness which Peter lacked. We need to recognize, far more than we often do, that we are fallible, that we are weak, that we can't cope, that we can't stand in the face of temptation. We need to recognize just what swaying reeds we are. We need to recognize how frail, how fragile we are. We need to have that self-awareness, which we too should have learned by now from all our many experiences of letting Jesus down. Because then, you see, again, if we have that self-awareness, then when we're approaching whatever the temptation might be for us, whether it's the television, the internet, the shops, a particular person, a particular place, whatever it might be, when we're approaching that, we won't just sail in unprepared, but already the alarm bells will be ringing, already the red light's flashing. We need to cultivate this self-awareness that we are weak and jettison any thoughts of, oh yeah, I can cope, I will lay down my life for Jesus, no problem. So there's a deficiency in his self-awareness. Secondly, there is a deficiency in his spiritual discipline. You might want to turn for a moment to Mark's Gospel, chapter 14. Mark chapter 14, again, well-known passages, well-known verses. This is in Gethsemane now. And Jesus then is there with his three closest friends, Peter, James, and John, and he's in a real state. He's overwhelmed with sorrow and he's in a state of inner turmoil and inner grief. And he goes off then to pray, and you all know the prayer that Jesus prays. But then in verse 37, we read in verse 34, before he goes off to pray, he has said to his disciples, stay here, to these three, stay here and keep watch. But then in verse 37 we read, he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. And it's interesting then, he doesn't address Peter, James and John, it's just Peter, isn't it? He turns to Peter. Simon, he said to Peter, are you asleep? The disciples are all sleeping, but it's Peter he addresses. Are you asleep? Could you not keep watch for 1 hour? Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is weak, but the spirit is willing, but the body is weak. And then once more, Jesus goes away and prays again. And then he comes back in verse 40, and again he finds them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. They did not know what to say to him. And do you see what is going on here then? That as Peter approaches this night, the night of Jesus' arrest, he doesn't only approach with this devastating lack of self-awareness, with this inexcusable self-confidence, but he approaches it prayerlessly, doesn't he? There in the Garden of Gethsemane, he'd had the opportunity to pray. Indeed, he'd had the command to pray. Jesus said, watch and pray. But instead, he had slept. And so he approaches that courtyard. He approaches that scene prayerlessly. He approaches it not having been in prayer with his God. And I'm sure then that we're meant to see a connection, that it was because he approached it. This was one reason why he failed. It was because he approached that scene prayerlessly. It was because he had slept instead of prayed that night. That night when Jesus was praying, and Jesus was making sure that he was ready and he was prepared and he was equipped for what was to come. Peter, by contrast, had been sleeping and he was most unequipped and unprepared for what was to come. And again then, that connection still holds true. That prayerlessness so often can lead to us failing our Lord Jesus Christ. That a lack of spiritual discipline can so often lead to this kind of failure. Because you see, when we're prayerless, when we've not been praying, then God and the truths concerning God and concerning the gospel and all the different truths of Scripture, they become remote, don't they? Yes, of course we haven't disavowed them, we haven't jettisoned them, but they're just remote, they're distant, they're not vivid in our minds. And when, therefore, temptation comes, there's a sufficient distance about them, a sufficient remoteness that makes the yielding to temptation possible. It makes it viable, and we yield. Now, I'm not going to dictate to you that every single day at this particular time, from this minute and this second to this minute and this second, you should be on your knees praying. But I am going to say to you that it's just an enduring principle, that prayerlessness leads to failure. Prayerlessness leads to sin. It leads to disobedience. It leads to us being unprepared, as Peter was, for temptation and for the assaults of the evil one. We're well on through the summer now, but at the beginning of the summer, John Piper wrote some very pertinent words concerning how we should approach the summer as believers, the summer months. And he wrote this: "Don't let summer make your soul shrivel. Flight from God into Christless leisure makes the soul parched. At first it may feel like freedom and fun to skimp on prayer and neglect the word. But then we pay. Shallowness, powerlessness, vulnerability to sin, preoccupation with trifles, superficial relationships, and a frightening loss of interest in worship and the things of the Spirit." And what John Piper was referring to the summer is relevant not just to the summer months, but to our lives generally. That neglect on prayer, on spiritual discipline, on being much in the Word and in prayer, engaging with our God, communing with our God, it leads to failure and to problems in our obedience. So that was a second deficiency. There was a deficiency in his spiritual discipline. But then thirdly, there was a deficiency in his theological understanding. There was a deficiency in his theological understanding. You see, there in John 13, again, the passage that we read earlier on, when Peter makes that claim, "I will lay down my life for you," it's almost certain, I think, that he meant it in this sense. He meant basically, "Look, Jesus, when you get into difficulty, I'll be your bodyguard. When you need me, when you're in problems, when you're struggling, I'll be there for you. I'll come and help you. Don't worry, Jesus. You've got me. I'll be there for you. You needn't worry what's going to happen, because I'll lay down my life for you. I'll be there to protect you and to help you in your hour of crisis." This becomes clear, doesn't it? It becomes clear that that's what Peter meant when Jesus is actually arrested. And what does Peter do? He instinctively pulls out his sword and starts to fight. There he is, you see. He sees himself as Jesus' bodyguard. Jesus is now being threatened. He's going to be arrested. And so Peter jumps in to rescue Jesus and to sort things out for him. Now, again, that may be quite well-meaning and natural and understandable, that impulse in Peter. But the trouble is, you see, that that impulse to kind of help Jesus out, to be there for Jesus, to be there supporting him and helping him when he needs us, that impulse can only take us so far. And yes, it took Peter through the arrest, and it took Peter even all the way to the high priest's courtyard. But then it became unstuck, and it couldn't carry him any further than that. And it couldn't carry him when these people came up and started to interrogate him. And it couldn't give him sufficient resolve in those moments of the severest temptation to stand up for Jesus Christ. And you see, what Peter needed to understand was that in actual fact, it was the exact opposite of what Peter said there in John 13:37. It wasn't that Peter was going to lay down his life for Jesus. It was that Jesus was going to lay down his life for Peter. I think Jesus is himself kind of teasing that out, the irony of it. In verse 38 of John 13, will you really lay down your life for me? I don't think so, Peter. I'm going to lay down my life for you. And I think this, in fact, is emphasized in John 18 itself, the account of the denial that we read earlier on. The fascinating thing about John's account is the way in which he interweaves the denials, isn't it? He doesn't give us all the denials at once, but he gives us one denial in verses 15 to 18. And then he shifts the focus to Jesus, who is being interrogated by the high priest. And then after that, he goes back again to Peter and gives us denials number 2 and 3. Why is that? Well, I think it's precisely for this reason, to establish a contrast between Peter and Jesus. That here is Peter, and in the moment of pressure, in the moment of interrogation, he's just denying everything in order to get off the hook. But here's Jesus on the other hand. And in his moment of pressure, and in his moment of interrogation, when he could have denied everything and said, no, I'm not the Christ. No, 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 you've mistaken me. And he could have said that in order to get off the hook. He doesn't. He doesn't do anything that would relieve the pressure on him and let him off the hook. And again, it's John emphasizing who's laying down his life for who here. Not Peter for Jesus, but Jesus for Peter. And you see, if Peter had understood that then, if he'd got things in their proper order, that no, it's not him laying down his life for Jesus, it's Jesus laying down his life for him, then at that moment when a servant girl came up in the high priest's courtyard, at that moment when another man came up and began to put the pressure on him, he wouldn't have needed to kind of try and persuade himself in that moment, look, I've got to do this for Jesus. I've got to protect Jesus. I've got to help Jesus. I've got to meet Jesus' needs in this moment. He wouldn't have needed to do that. But instead, he could have thought, Jesus is right now in that room over there, in the process of laying down his life for me, in the process of saving me from eternal damnation, in the process of delivering me from eternal hell. I want to lay down my life for Jesus. I want to serve him. I want to stand for him in this moment. I want to honor him. I want to please him, because this is what he's doing for me. You see, if he got things in the right order, the grace of Jesus Christ first, then the service, then the sacrifice would have followed naturally from that. And it applies to us as well. If we're going to stand up for Jesus in moments of pressure and temptation, then we need to get out of this mindset of kind of beating ourselves, scourging ourselves in this moment. I've got to do this for Jesus. It's a duty. I've got to perform it. This kind of law mentality. And we've got to put grace first and think, look, he's done all this for me. I'll do anything for him. Because anything I can do is nothing compared to what he's done for me. We need this theological understanding. Grace comes first. He's done everything for us. And therefore we want to do for him what he wants us to do. And I'm sure that when Peter did eventually lay down his life for Jesus, when eventually Peter, it seems almost certain, became a crucified martyr many decades later, I'm sure he did it not out of that sense of duty, I must do this, which had driven him into the high priest's courtyard, but he did it out of this sense, Jesus laid down his life for me in far worse circumstances than I'll ever lay down my life for him. He laid down his life for me, bearing my sin, bearing my hell. This is nothing in comparison. May God help us. Amen.